Let's have a word of prayer and we'll look into the Word of God. Our Father, we're thankful for the privilege you give us as believers of opening your Word. We're thankful that we have your Word. We're thankful that it is not the Word of men. There were men that wrote these things down, but they were men that were born along by your Spirit to write exactly and precisely what you wanted said. And we're thankful then that we can have a copy of that, and we can read it for ourselves so that as we learn these things, we know what you want us to know. We can think along with you some of the things that you think, and we're thankful for that privilege. And we're thankful for the lessons of history, the things that we learn as we go back and we consider these previous dispensations, that there is something for us today to learn from these situations, from the way these people responded. And we ask for that, and we might have a grasp of that today, and we thank you for it. Amen. Last week we started looking at the dispensation of conscience. We looked at the fact, as always, that God is the master of this household. We saw that Cain was supposed to be the steward or manager of the household, but because Cain did not respond, he did not follow the promise that God gave him, so he didn't bring the proper offering. And then when God even came and gave him an alternative, he rejected that alternative and offered up his brother as a sacrifice to God. Then he went out and established civilization without God. Most of what you and I assume is civilization or culture today are things that developed outside of God. That's really important. I don't know what life would be like on earth. I just can't even begin to imagine. I really can't imagine what life on this earth would be like if these things had not taken place. Because we are so accustomed to the way things are, right? The way things are is the way things are. It's hard for us to imagine that it could have been any different. But a lot of this culture developed as a result of Cain departing from the presence of God. We're going to be over in the book of Genesis here. And so if you want to open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 4, that's where we're going to be looking at this. We've talked about this conscience, and we may not be in Genesis 4 here immediately, but this is where we're going to be here in a moment. But why do we say that conscience is a rule? I mean, it's kind of like going back in the last case and saying, well, we call that the dispensation of innocence. But we actually don't, nowhere in the Bible does it ever call Adam and Eve innocent. And it never calls that the dispensation of innocence. In fact, if you remember, there's only three dispensations that are named specifically. Two of them, dispensation of grace, dispensation of fullness of times, and then law is identified by contrast to the dispensation of grace. But if we go back here, why did we say innocence with Adam and Eve? Because they were untried. Because they did not know good or evil. So they're operating really in a state of innocence, not really knowing what will make them happy, what will bring disaster. They don't know this. They're on the other side of sin. They don't know. You and I come into this world knowing sin. In fact, probably one of the first words that your child learns to say is no. Because by the time that they actually open their mouth and actually articulate something, they've probably heard the word no a lot. Because you're telling them, no, don't touch that. No, don't put that in your mouth. No, don't play with that. No, icky. No, no, no. And they do it from the time they're actually very young that you have to kind of start communicating these things to your children. So they don't know what it's like. We don't know what it's like to raise in a world where you don't have to be told no all the time. Because there are things that are evil. Things that, and by evil means, things that'll bring disaster. No, don't touch the stove. It's hot. It's disastrous. No, don't put your finger. I had an aunt, one of my mom's sisters, that they, you know, those things on the wall that you plug stuff into? We call those electric outlet. Oh, you call them outlets. When I was growing up, we always called them sockets. And my aunt did not call them sockets. She called them shockets. Because she used to take bobby pins. The girls always wore bobby pins, and she would take them out and stick them in those all the time as little kids. And this is before they had those protective covers and everything. All parents, you know, when we had little kids, we had every outlet. If you weren't using it, it was covered. And if you unplugged something, you immediately put that cover back on it because you didn't want that to happen. But my aunt used to stick them in, so she called them shockets. And she used to get in trouble for it all the time. But I don't know how much trouble the child gets in for sticking stuff in there. They've already kind of gotten in trouble by getting zapped, right? We tell them that thing because you're trying to constantly say, that'll bring disaster on you. A child could seriously get hurt sticking something in an electric socket, an outlet. Now we come to the dispensation of conscience. Now mankind knows good and evil. They think they know what'll make them happy, and they think they know what'll bring disaster. And so now they're supposed to operate with this conscience as a rule. And that's what conscience is. It's trying to weigh activity and knowledge to bring about a sense of well-being, to try to make things good and try to avoid disaster. Of course, this is always in our thinking about, well, this is what'll make me happy, right? Over the holidays, I hate to have to admit this, but probably starting somewhere back in November, isn't that when they start? I thought that, oh, this will taste good, that'll make me happy, and this will taste good, and this will make me happy, and this will taste good, and this will make me happy, and this will taste good, and my scales got way off balance, and literally, if I had a scale, my scale would be off balance, because I probably gained another 10 to 15 pounds. Somebody told me the other day they gained over 20, and I was kind of shocked. I would not have guessed that with them, but it throws it out of whack because of something. And so now I'm actually not happy. I'm actually kind of grumpy about the fact that I didn't control myself better than that. And that's an example of, well, I think it'll make me happy, but oftentimes it doesn't. Conscience is a rule. Conscience is a person's mental faculty which then balances his or her knowledge with activity. It could be his, hers, or another's. I mean, if you are raised in a family where your parents teach you or taught you, we don't do this. We don't do this kind of thing. I grew up in a family, we didn't cuss. Well, go listen to Tim Hawkins online. He's a Christian comedian. He'll tell you about Christian swear words. Those are the only kind of things that we ever said. Dosh, gosh darn it, things like that. Those are the only things we could get away with saying, you know. But we didn't swear. And I remember going to grade school, and most of the kids didn't when I first was in grade school, but somewhere along in second grade, all of a sudden I start hearing kids use these words, and I'm always like, no, wait for lightning to strike or something like this, because you don't talk like this. See? We didn't do this at all in my house growing up. And so that's why I say it could be his, hers, or another. If I would have sworn, oh, my conscience would have been way out of whack. But my conscience was out of whack if I heard other people swear. See? Because it didn't match, you know, the way I was raised. Conscience attempts to maintain one's sense of well-being in keeping with what one knows. Now, there is a problem in there, and it has to do with what one knows. Sometimes what you know is wrong. Sometimes your mom and daddy didn't raise you with the right things. In fact, as Ben's class, as they're going over with Tim Kimmel in there, sometimes maybe your mom and daddy raised you that success is about right the right education, going to the right school. It's about making the most money. It's all about worldly success. And there's nothing wrong with worldly success, but if you're pursuing that and that's the way you gauge success, your mom and daddy raised you wrong. Because real success, according to Scripture, is to be a servant to others. And if God allows, if God has planned for you to be successful from a certain world standard, but you also are serving, that's okay. But if you elevate this kind of other service over, your mom and daddy raised you wrong. And so your conscience could be out of balance because you're going, well, this isn't making me, taking time to lay my life down for other people. That, guess what? That impinges on my time. That conflicts with the time that I need to pursue my success. And it happens, I remember way back in college, talking with fellow college students about the fact that, you know what, you go to college and they say, well, you got to put in X number of study hours every week per class. That doesn't allow me to take time with believers, doesn't allow me to take time with Bible study, and already you can say something's wrong here. because God's never going to ask you to do something that's going to be in conflict. I have to work 80 hours a week to make money to become successful. That leaves me, I don't have time for church. Could have used, I always want to think of it when I think of success. I know different examples of this where I've watched people on both sides of this model, and I appreciated Dwight sharing about Michael. Most of you know Michael, about Michael going from very successful working for a company that has him working crazy long hours and traveling all over and being gone to a job where not as successful, maybe from the world's point of view, not making, Dwight will tell you, doesn't make as much, but guess what? He's done at work every day at 3, and he's home with his family, and they're not calling him up at all hours of the day to do stuff. And guess what? Is that a type of success? I bet his family thinks so. I bet they appreciate it. I bet he appreciates to be able to have time, because I've known people that are successful like this, but they lose their family in the process because, well, dad's never home, or mom for that matter. But so anyway, just trying to give you some examples that sometimes your knowledge, and Ben's class provided a really good example of that. There's a lot of things that knowledge could be about, okay? Could be swearing, like I was using. I grew up thinking that swearing is just one of the worst things in the world. It's almost going to land you in hell, you know? Well, you know, I've had to kind of modify my thinking. I still don't think it's a great thing to go around swearing and such, but you know what? I've had to modify my thinking on that a little bit. It's not particularly the worst thing in the world. So conscience, think of it as a balance scale. Balances what I know with what I do, or what maybe another person does in this case. And so lying is wrong. I lied. Balance scales are out. My conscience is out of whack. Now all of a sudden I've got a guilty conscience. We get that idea. I think you understand that. Good conscience, lying is wrong. I tell the truth. Ah, your balance scales are equal. Feels good, right? That's an idea. This is an understanding of what conscience is. And I tell you, this really helped me in my Christian life to understand something about conscience, because I used to struggle with conscience because sometimes I have the knowledge aspect wrong. Sometimes when you get the knowledge aspect wrong, it helps you. And you get your knowledge, like I said, from your culture, from your peers, from your parents, from your... There's a lot of different influences on what affects your knowledge in there. So conscience is the rule. Adam and Eve then, as we've already said, gained the ability to know good and evil. But now the question is, would they use that ability to choose good and not evil? And remember, good and evil does not mean righteous versus unrighteous. It means that which produces a genuine sense of well-being versus that which brings about disaster. And like I said, sometimes that's short-sighted. I can guarantee you every morsel of food I put in my mouth from Thanksgiving through New Year's tasted good. I didn't eat anything going, oh, this is the nastiest cake ever, but I'm going to eat the whole piece because I'm committed. I was never like that. It was like every bite tasted good, but there was a consequence. And so in that sense, I didn't really balance good and evil, because it seemed good on one side, but the long-term consequence for me over here, the evil in this case, the disaster, it's not comfortable. I don't like that, okay? So conscience is a rule. Cain, as an example, failed to choose the good. He did not bring the proper sacrifice. However, Abel did by faith. He did bring that. And faith implies that God had a promise. This is a lot of review. Cain failed to choose to do the good. Even when God provided an alternative, he didn't do it. And we already talked about that last week with evil crouching, or excuse me, a sin offering crouching at his door. Jim actually even made a comment. We have no idea. This is just pure conjecture at this point. But who was a tender of the sheep, raiser of the flocks? Abel. And when it says in there that his desire, Abel's desire will be for you, God might be indicating in there as he's talking about that maybe Abel's the one that came and brought the sin offering and set it outside the door of his brother's place. We don't know that. But there is something where he says Abel's desire would be for Cain, is what he's getting at here. It's not that the sin offering's desire is for Cain. It's talking about Abel's desire. Abel wouldn't have fought and said, well, this is no fair. I brought the right sacrifice. Why is Cain getting to be the steward? It wouldn't have been that way at all, because Abel offered his by faith, and Abel was righteous. We're told that over in 1 John. It says he was righteous and his brother's works were not. So,
wasn't he walking with him, basically, and talking with him?
Well,
to know what sacrifice
we don't know that for sure that he was at that time. We know that we know that God had come down and had talked with their parents. Whether he had talked specifically with Cain and Abel up to that point, that we don't know. Again, that would be, yeah, kind of like saying that Abel brought the thing. That's a conjecture. We don't know that for sure. It's maybe a possibility based on a little bit of the information. Now, the question is the human race, also the human race then used conscience to plan evil, disaster. So much so that it says, if you look, and I said Genesis 4, but if you look in Genesis 6, I think we ended here last week, but Genesis chapter 6, all that was a lot of review, I realized, but Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, it says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great." And by the way, the word wickedness there is a variation on the word evil. It's all it is. It's a form of the word ra that he uses there. The wickedness or evil of man, that is, man was bringing disaster on himself. It was great in the earth. In other words, he doesn't bring just a little disaster upon himself. He brings a lot of disaster on himself, so that every imagination or intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, or, as I told you in the Hebrew, all the day. All he could do was think about those things that would make his life worse. And he's not, in other words, I keep using the example of me eating, but could you imagine if that's all I continued to think about all day long? All I thought about was eating. And every time I saw food, I stuffed it in my face. Could you imagine how that would eventually, my wife's going, no. But eventually that would be disaster. See, eventually that would, if that's all I focused on, but that's what he's saying here. These people just focus on something that brings them disaster. To them, it looks like a good thing, but it's not. And this is what we're going to be talking about here a little bit. So now back to Genesis chapter 4. Let's just walk quickly through the development of civilization outside of God. Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 16, it says, "And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden." But the first, most important thing is he went out from the presence of the Lord. He doesn't stick around. He doesn't ask God for more help. He's not interested in God's help. I'm going to figure this out myself. And he goes out and he leaves God. And so everything that develops from this point on is going to be a development of these problems. I don't know how well you can see those up there. It's a little small on my screen here, but the human race then develops civilization away from God. So let's look down here in this context. Verse 19, Cain, first of all, we could actually look in verse 17, and he built a city called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And then we see a family tree coming down to a man by the name of Lamech. In other words, all this stuff doesn't just develop just boom like that. It does take a little bit of time. But verse 19, "And Lamech took for himself two wives." Now right there, that's polygamy or bigamy. It's not the way God did it. God didn't take two ribs out of Adam's side and make two wives for him. He made him a single counterpart. But mankind is not satisfied with that. So mankind's going to go on. And they begin to focus on this. And so he ends up taking two wives, it tells us. And it says, verse 20, "And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock." I actually had a question about Cain last week from the Greens that they asked Monday morning. And they said, why did he raise livestock? What was it? They weren't eating meat yet. We're going to see that next week when they come off the ark. They're not yet eating meat. Okay. So what were they raising livestock for? Well, two things. What were Adam and Eve wearing? By God's design, clothing made of skins. Okay, so they're wearing some sort of clothing made of skins. I don't know what that clothing looked like. I don't think that they were wearing, you know, the Cro-Magnon man garment that you see in the silly science and history books. They're probably wearing something approximating clothing much better, but they were made out of skins. Something had to die to provide for that. And the thing is animal skins wear out, and like anything else, and so there's a chance that this is the other thing that they're doing. He's raising livestock. But they also, from livestock, what else do you get from them? You get animals for sacrifice, which Cain and Abel did bring sacrifices, so that may have been exactly one of the purposes. And you also do eat from them without eating meat. I love cheese. I love cheese. And when I was a kid, when I was like the Garnix boys' ages or the Key boys here, I'm telling you, I drank two tall glasses of 2% milk. Actually, it was whole milk when I was a kid, and then we switched to 2% because that was supposed to be a little better for you. I drink two of those every meal. So two for breakfast, two for lunch, two for supper, and probably one before I went to bed. So I drank a lot of milk. I don't know how my parents afforded all the milk that we drank or I drank when I was a kid. But you... And they could have used them for travel or work. I don't know that they would have done that so much with sheep, but and you also would have wool from animals. So I'm just trying to throw out some possibilities. But what happens now? So how is Jabel any different than what Cain or what Abel was doing? I would say he's actually now turning this into, from what I can understand, he's turning this into a commercial enterprise. It never says that that's what Abel was doing before. He's maybe just doing this for himself, maybe helping the family out in that regard. But from the way I would understand the development of the city and culture, this is actually now taking something that wasn't intended to be a commercial enterprise and making a commercial enterprise out of raising this, which is most people that raise beef today, livestock today, it's a commercial enterprise. A few people raise a couple steers for themselves. But that's not the norm, okay? Just saying, I'm suggesting this as you understand this. Verse 21, and the brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and the flute. Is music definitely a part of culture? Yeah. Your culture is really defined in so many ways by music. And we could even go beyond music. We could say even just by the arts in general, by the way that we entertain and celebrate things like that. It's all about that. When I was in college, one of the papers I had to write, on the architecture of ancient Greece was I did one I'm not even going to say it right. It's not the frieze, but it's the band that goes around the top inside the Parthenon in Athens, and it's a celebration of the Peloponnesian Games in which the Greeks celebrated their victories in the Peloponnesian Wars. And I got in trouble with my professor because I said, it's humanism as at heart. And I wasn't using that in a negative or pejorative sense in any way. I'm simply saying, it's man celebrating man. But he goes, you can't do that. Humanism didn't exist at that time. Humanism is a 20th century invention. And I was like, whatever. So as a result, I got a B instead of an A on the paper because I misapplied the concept of humanism. Anyway, that's a form of art. But what is it? It's a celebration of something. What they were doing was those Greeks were celebrating their victory in these wars. And so they put together these games to celebrate this. Well, we have these people. What do you do with music? You celebrate. You celebrate love. You celebrate family. You celebrate victory. You know, or you mourn the loss of love, or you mourn defeat in war and things like that. There's a lot of different things. In fact, that one song we sing here that's based on the song Danny Boy, isn't Danny Boy? It's actually a sad song, isn't it? It's about a guy that goes off and doesn't come home from war, if I remember correctly, I think. It's mourning his loss. I might be wrong on that, but this is what music does. But culture is the one that developed this. See? Culture is the one that developed this. The human race developing in this civilization, we have industry. The next one that we have in here, verse 22, and as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor, or literally one that is a builder or manufacturer in bronze and iron. Really, to me, this is a very important or interesting one, because if you remember, what was part of the curse that came on Adam in particular because he ate the fruit? Tilling the earth was going to be labor intensive. It was going to cause him to sweat. For those of you that have ever done farming, I always say this. Can you imagine what farming would be like on the other side of the curse? I can't. But now farming is hard work. And it causes sweat and exhaustion. It didn't before. It didn't before because the earth was more productive prior to the curse. Today, it takes a lot to get a crop out of the earth. Okay? It takes a lot to get a crop out of the earth. And this man actually began to develop these bronze and iron implements, which people look at that and go, say, ah, the Bible's wrong because bronze is a alloy, right? It's an alloy. And so, well, they didn't know how to make alloys back then because our secular history says man was too dumb back then to have figured that out. These people were much smarter than we understand, and they actually knew how to make bronze. Okay. And we don't quibble with that. We take a biblical take on history, not what the secular world says. But what they're trying to do is, I would say, they're trying to lessen the curse. They're trying to make the curse easier to handle. Isn't it a lot easier to go out there and have an implement pulled behind an ox when you're tilling a field than it is to go out there all day with a shovel and try to do that? Or a stick? Could you imagine just trying to... I've seen footage, you probably have seen it too, of people in third world nations. Of course, this is long ago. Most of those people in third world nations now have more modern implements, but I've seen them where they basically make a plow made out of big sticks and they put it behind an animal and they got to drive that through, but that thing wears out a lot faster than an iron implement would. So I'm just trying to point out this whole idea of what man's doing is they're trying to bring about their own good by doing what? Celebrating with music. Polygamy is better than monogamy. Having these implements that make my life easier, you know. I'm looking up a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that I think helps answer exactly what you're getting. In verse 31, Paul's talking about putting everything in perspective. He says in verse 31 of 1 Corinthians 7, and those who make use of the world as though they did not make use or full use of it, or they don't use it to the full. So in other words, does God also have music? Yeah, when you have the law instituted, there's music. They celebrate with music. And such like this. When they bring the ark into the city, they're playing music and David sings and dances in the streets. But what God says to do is not to make full use of it. In other words, as a Christian, your whole life could be focused on music. Music is life. No, it's not God's life. Christ is my life. And maybe music is something by which I can express that, but I'm not going to become obsessed with it. Okay, so we can be obsessed with making use of things that are part of the world system, thinking we're always going to make it better. We're going to make life easier. And that isn't necessarily always our goal. We can be upset. Maybe God lets us make our life easier. But we might become obsessed with trying to make our life easier. And God says, just do it. Just do the job.
So the key is not
it's balance.
That. The key is that he went out from the presence of the Lord and to depend on these other things, not
so we might be able to use some of these things. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we just don't make full use of them. We don't make them an end in themselves, is what we're trying to say. Okay? We can become obsessed with this. We have one girl mentioned in this, apart from the wives. We have a sister that they have. Her name is Naamah. Her name means beauty. Outward beauty, by the way. Which I find really interesting because... What does the world tell girls from the time they're little is the most valuable quality in them? Being beautiful. Being pretty. That's not a 20th century invention. It's been like that going back here to early human history that the world system tells you, you better look good. And if you don't look good, you better do whatever you can to look better. And the Bible tells us, we just actually looked at an example of this. What? Yeah, we were just reading about Jacob, Rebecca, and Leah. How come Jacob didn't fall in love with Leah? Because it said she had weak, New American, or we were in the ESV, it says she had weak eyes. It's an expression probably meaning, probably walked up here and went, whoa. Because her eyes probably weren't quite right. They were wonky. I don't know exactly how to describe it because I don't know what she looked like. And he didn't fall in love with her. He was impressed by Rachel. Yeah, because it says she was beautiful. It says Rachel was beautiful. See? And I would venture to say, most guys I've known, when they get married, usually they don't say, I'm going to go out and find myself the hideous girl I can so that I know that I really love her for something other than looks. We don't usually do that, do we? But again, it comes down to the fact, you don't make it an end in yourself. Ladies, girls, there's nothing wrong with being pretty, but boy, don't be obsessed with it. Looks are temporary. What did Peter say? We just looked at this the other night in 1 Peter 3. The person that ought to be most in person is who you are inside. Because that's a person that doesn't change. The color of your hair can change over time. Of course, you can change it back now. Maybe they always have been able to do that, you know? And you can go in and you can look better. Sure you can. Yeah. Yeah, whatever. But we can be obsessed with the wrong kinds of things. And the focus on beauty for women is one of those things in that regard. And then the last one thing that's mentioned in here, in this context, in verse 23, it says, and Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, wives of Lamech, listen to the speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. It doesn't say he tried to kill me. He says, he just wounded me, struck me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 70 and sevenfold. And the point being is, the world system really goes to excess when we talk about violence. And there is a lot of violence in the world system. And the world system actually pushes and encourages excesses on these things. And this is the situation that we have illustrated here. So, in this regard then, man did not choose good with conscience. Man values what is contrary to God. Now we're going to move on to the next example of what happens and turn to chapter 6. And it would be interesting to spend a whole day just sitting on this topic and developing this study, but we're going to keep this somewhat brief. It says in verse 1 of Genesis 6, and it came to pass when men began to multiply in the face of the earth that daughters were born to them. And the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Now there is a teaching that I do not believe is right. In fact, I think in Peggy's Sunday school class, that's what their lessons taught, is that the sons of God, well, that's what the lesson taught. You didn't go this way, right? That the sons of God were the line of Seth. In other words, from Adam to Seth, these were all good people, sons of God. They're all doing what? Okay. But there are people that teach that. And then there's Cain's line, and Cain's line's wrong. And these lines are supposed to stay separate like this. But now they come together, and now we have a problem. And of course, that works really well into a thing where you basically want to tell your boys and girls in your church, stay away from unsaved kids. Don't marry them. Okay? Which is true. But that's not the point of this account that we have here. This account is something completely different, because the expression sons of God, we have a couple of other places where it is used. It's used in Job 3 times, okay? And so I'm just going to look at them up here for the sake of time, but Job chapter 1 and verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Who are those sons of God? Who are they, Jeremy? They're angels. They're spirit beings. Exactly. We have it repeated in Job 2:1. Same thing. And then Job 38:7, it says, when the morning stars sang, those are the stars that they shine, we call our sun as one of these, sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Those spirit beings were around when God created the universe, and they shouted for joy. It wasn't us. Now, guess what? Those are the three places that the expression sons of God occur in the Old Testament other than Genesis 6. the sons of God are not the godly line of Seth, which it never says in the book of Genesis. The sons of God are spirit beings. They're angels. We've had a deviation. This used to be, in fact, the Jews understood this for years. Even prior to the time of Christ, the Jews understood these to be angels. And the Jews understood what happened as a result of this. They understood that there were giants involved in this. But now we come into modern society and modern thinking and modern education. We're not so dumb as to believe in giants. Come on, those are for stories you tell to your kids at night when you put them to bed. Jack and the Beanstalk and the giants, stuff like that. Giants. And so we've had all kinds of other attempts to develop an alternative in modern Bible teaching to this. But as we've demonstrated, just looking at the expression sons of God, we can see that you're talking about spirit beings. And so, if we look on down here in this context, verse 3, in response, and notice right off the bat in verse 3, right in response to the sons of God taking wives of the daughters of men, it says, and the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever. For he indeed is flesh, yet his days will be 120 years. That's approximately how long it's going to take them, take Noah, to build this box. We call it a boat or an ark, but it's a box. And there were, now notice, I have New King James that I'm reading from this morning. It says, there were giants on the earth. The word giant is this word Nephilim. It's a word that traditionally we've understood to mean fallen ones. However, the interesting thing about this is that the Jews never translated this fallen ones when they brought it over into Greek. They translated it giants. The Jews did. And that's why we in your older English Bibles have giants, because we followed the way the Jews translated it. And they translated it giants because that was, guess what? That was the way they understood it from their long distant history. And so it says there were giants or fallen ones on the earth in those days and also afterwards. In other words, what's going to happen with the flood won't end this. This will be repeated so that when Israel comes into their land, guess what? There's still going to be these beings around. They're going to be there and they're going to have to face them in this context. It says, but afterwards, and it says when. Yeah.
So do you mean that afterwards that
That the angels do this again? Yes, they repeat this. Now, not all the angels, because, again, we could spend a whole morning teaching this, but there are a group of angels that are actually put away in a place called Tartarus at this time, according to Peter. They're locked away. So obviously they can't repeat it, so there have to be some other angels that repeat this. Okay. And so also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. In other words, it's not just saying, oh, it was around that same time that this was going on that we also had this. No, he's talking about, he's telling us, he says that you have these giants. And it happened at this time, it happened later, but it was happening when the sons of God were coming into the daughters of men. These then were mighty ones, and they were men of renown, or men of a name. So, when it talks about this Nephilim, we also find in Scripture that the Nephilim are also known as, I didn't put the scripture reference up here. I'm sorry. This has to do with the spies that go into the land, and when they come back and they said, there we also saw the Nephilim. This is the only other time we see the term Nephilim outside of this. The sons of Anak are from the Nephilim. They came from that. And we became like grasshoppers in our sight. That's the way we were to them. That's what they're saying. We look at a grasshopper and go, they're little to us. He says, us to them, we were little. And again, I read a couple commentaries that they're going, yeah, they're exaggerating here. Well, maybe the grasshopper to human was a little bit of an exaggeration, but they're not exaggerating in terms of this, okay? They're not exaggerating in terms of this. Now, the point of this, here when he talks about this, and keep your finger here, but turn over I do want to look at these other passages to see that this was something even afterwards and more common. Turn to Genesis 14. Genesis 14. Now, what happens in Genesis chapter 14 is you have the battle of the kings, in which Abraham's going to go off and have to, with his basically a small private army, and he's going to have to go off and rescue his nephew Lot. But in verse 5, it says, "And in the 14th year of Chedorlaomer, and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Enim in Sheba, the Kerithim, and the Horites in the mountain of Seir," and so on. But it refers to these, the Rephaim, the Zuzim, and the Enim. Now turn in your Bibles over to the book of Deuteronomy. As they're rehearsing their history before entering in the land, going to follow Joshua, because Moses is not going to take them into the land. If you look in Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 10. Now we saw, if you remember back here, this is from the book of Numbers, this verse here. I'm sorry, I forgot to put the reference down, and I don't. 1333, my wife says, okay. This says that the Nephilim, it says the sons of Anak are from the Nephilim, okay, the sons of Anak. So, keep this in mind now as we go to Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 10. "The Emim had dwelt there in times past, a people as great and numerous and," notice what it says, "and tall as the Anakim." Now, the Anakim were descendants of the Rephaim. "They were regarded as giants, like the Anakim. But the Moabites called them the," we just saw these over in Genesis, the Moabites called them the Emim. The Moabites called them the Emim. In other words, what we do is we have several different names for these, because not everybody calls them the same thing. And I think you and I understand that. We've got different people, if you go in different places, different people refer to different things by different terms. Now, one of the arguments against this is a statement that we have in Matthew chapter 22, in which Jesus is being tested, and somebody says, okay, the Sadducees, remember, don't believe in the resurrection. And so the Sadducees say, oh, we got one for you. We've got one. We're going to catch you here in a trap. Okay, there's a man, and he marries a woman, and he has no children, and he dies. And so, remember, the order under the Jews was, is her brother was supposed to take her and marry her, and he's supposed to raise up children. So the second brother does that, but they have no children. The third brother, and there's seven brothers, by the end, they all die in each time, and the woman keeps marrying each one of the brothers like she was supposed to under the law. And so at the end, she's been married to seven different guys, seven brothers. And they say, okay, we got you. In the resurrection, whose wife is she? And Jesus says, in Matthew chapter 22, and I'm going to go to verse 29. Jesus said, you are mistaken. You don't understand the scriptures or the power of God. For in the resurrection, they do not marry, nor are they given in marriage. But they are like the angels in heaven." Oh, we got you, Tim. Angels don't marry. Well, yeah, the angels in heaven don't marry. They're not up there having baby angels, contrary to, you know, the little things you might watch where you got the littlest angel and all that kind of nonsense and such. No, they don't have wings either, by the way. But anyway, the point is that Jesus is saying the angels of heaven, those we'd say the angels of God, the ones that are righteous and have remained loyal to God, they don't marry. God never intended them to. But these angels look down and see the daughters of men, and they want to marry them. In fact, the other day I was down at the library and I was shelving books and such, and I was putting some movies away, and there was a movie that was on there. I think it's called Michael, I think was the one, which was a movie with John Travolta in which he plays Michael the archangel that basically comes down and becomes a man and walks around men. And there's been several of these movies that were popular back in the 90s and the early 2000s about angels coming down and being like men and falling in love with women. I'm thinking, this is nothing new. What's telling you here in the Bible is nothing new. Men still think about this. And so, yeah, God's angels don't do this. But remember, a third of the angels went with Satan, according to Revelation 12. third of those spirit beings went with him, and it's those spirit beings that are being involved in this. Now go back over to Genesis chapter 6. Back to Genesis chapter 6. And notice what it says there in verse 4. It says, there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore to them. These then were mighty ones. They were men of renown. What does the word renown mean? They were famous. They were famous. Ben mentioned some names today that most grade school kids, I have heard those names. I don't pay a lot of attention, but I have heard those names. But Ben mentioned some names that people would think of as famous. But I bet all of you could probably mention somebody that is important to you, but's not famous. But see, we're not usually concerned about those kind of people in the world. In the world, outside of God, we're concerned about people that are really famous. And to be famous, you have to do something distinct. You have to have some unique and distinct ability. Maybe it's infamous because you do something, we say Hitler, you know, that's kind of an infamous name, meaning you did something that made you famous, but it wasn't good. Or you might talk about somebody that's, hey, I have a friend that used to say Franklin Delano Roosevelt was famous, but he became infamous. All depended on your perspective on whether or not you liked the advent of socialism in America, you know. And this guy said when he was young, he thought it was a good thing. As he became older, he realized it wasn't, you know. But he says, when you're young and you're struggling, well, yeah, we ought to all share. It ought to be forced on everybody. And then you grow up and go, oh, that's not so good. See, short-sighted. So things can go from infamous to famous back and forth. These men, these giants, were famous. Okay. Let's put this in perspective. I did this years ago with the kids, but I didn't do what we're going to do today here to try to illustrate this. Does anybody know how tall Goliath was when he faced? Oh, you're too short. He was about 9'9". Says nine. He said he was 6 cubits and a span. And a span was considered this. Now my hand is not a full span, but a span was about 9 inches, about half a cubit. Okay. And so he's about 9'9". Remember, a cubit is 18 inches. We're going by a standard cubit. So he's 9'9". Now, you think you know what 9'9 is, but we're going to give you an example. How tall are you, Edward? 6'2". How tall are you, Jeremy?
16.
Oh, you too? Okay. Doesn't make any difference. I always pick on your daughters, so you're going to come on up here and help me. Okay? No, you. Because I pick on your daughters, so their dad's going to help me today. I didn't know whether to choose you or Jeremy, okay? And Joseph's going to help me here in just a second, okay? Now, just to put this also in a little bit more perspective, 9'9", we're going to see 9'9 here in just a second, but there was a king called Og, king of Bashan, that was defeated when the Jews were going through the land. Og, king of Bashan, does anybody know how long his bed was?
19.
What? 13 feet was the length of his bed. That probably, why would it tell you the length of his bed? To say, man, this guy's rich. He's got a huge bed. No. Yeah, so you're talking about this guy was probably very tall. So he could have been 12 feet, which would have been another 2.5 feet longer. Ready, Joseph? Okay. Okay, well, we're going to see here in just a second. Joseph's going to help me.
You want to close your eyes?
Okay, close your eyes.
Close your eyes. Or look down.
We guys didn't close your eyes.
Mine are closed. Yeah. Mine just open up. Hey. Okay. Open. Oh.
Okay. Stand over here, Edward. He's Edward 6'2". You have to look up to that guy. This is Goliath size. As my wife said, Goliath's shoulders probably would have been taller. Now that's still not quite Goliath size. I didn't measure quite right when I was getting the length of this. His head would actually be touching those fan blades up there. So he would have been just that much taller. That's 9'9". Is that a big guy? Reach over and grab your dad. No. Yeah, use your...
I don't know how long their hands are. I used to be a big arm on this guy. Yeah, look at that. I mean, could you imagine what this is? So I did this because I was thinking, I don't think we can really grasp the idea of what it would be like to meet a guy that's 9'9". It's like Goliath. And to meet David, who's probably 6 foot. I'm a 5'10". That's my height. So.
Well, he might have been one of the shorter ones.
He would have been one of the shorter ones compared to Og, because Og would have been 2.5 feet taller than that. Approximately. Let's say 12 feet. I'm just going a foot shorter. You can go sit down, Edward.
Right, yeah.
Were they what? Bigger this way?
Yeah,
this
oh
way?
Yeah. And why? You can lay the guy down there, Joseph. Thank you. Nah, just lay him down here.
The irrigation district is 6'9".
He can be a job. Job.
In a farming society, you can see why every man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you hear? Did you hear what Josh said? Repeat that, Josh, real loud.
In a farming society, you can see why everybody wanted one of those when you didn't have tractors.
Yeah. Could you imagine how handy somebody that's really tall would be in an agricultural culture? You could see why these guys had become famous. And this wasn't just a couple of these. We don't have like 10 or 12 of these guys running around. How many of them were running around in Philistia in David's day that we know of? There were five. Because there was Goliath and he had four brothers. They were the five sons of Gath and they were all Nephilim. So there were five of them in Gath. Okay. But at the time that this was happening, let's go down and look in verses 11 here of Genesis chapter 6, verse 11. The earth also was ruined before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So you actually have violence. By the way, you hear this word, you hear the Hebrew word violence. You hear this if you ever listen to the news, because it's the word Hamas. You ever hear of a group called Hamas? It's the word violence. Okay, it's this word here. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Yeah, so it's not just, because he's not going to just kill man. He could have sent a disease through mankind that would have wiped out mankind. But he's going to drown it because it says all flesh had corrupted its way. This is why he's going to take care of even things that are breathing the air, other creatures. Because these spirit beings didn't stop with men. They end up perpetuating this even throughout the animal kingdom. And I think you can probably, I mean, look at, and again, this is conjecture on my part. But I often wonder, are the dinosaurs that we know of, are they a product of what this went on? Because to me, it's really interesting how obsessed children are with dinosaurs. And I'm thinking this would be a perfect thing within Satan and his world system to get the children all obsessed over something that actually was wrong. But they're going, wow, dinosaurs, way more interesting than a puppy. Well, unless you got one for your birthday. But a puppy, not a dinosaur. Although I think I probably know some kids that wish they could get a dinosaur for their birthday. Anyway, but all the world did this. So verse 12, so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. All of them. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And so he's going to, verse 7 back there, he says, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. There was the best way that God could express the way he looked at this, his displeasure was to say it's like a regrettable thing. But is God going, wow, Jim went over this with us a couple years ago at one of our Bible conferences. God going, well, that didn't work. Let's go back to the drawing board. Trinity, huddle. Let's get in here and see if we can figure out a better way to do this. This is not what God's doing. God's not sitting there going, man, how in the world could I have been such a knucklehead doing, you know? God doesn't do that. God doesn't have that issue. But the best way he could express this to us was that he looked at this thing that he created and he found no pleasure in it. This isn't like looking at the original creation and going, it's good, which he did. Now he looks at it and sees this is what they've done with this. This is not good. This is a regrettable thing, not a positive thing that comes out of this. But men treated it as positive. These men are famous. Everybody wants to know these guys. In fact, maybe put this in perspective when it talks about how famous these are and how it said all flesh had corrupted their way. What if you were as a parent were going, honey, just wait till I meet the guy I've set you up with. Here, meet Eli the angel. You're going to marry him and we're going to have big grandkids. Seriously. I'm not saying that's exactly what happened, but it puts in perspective because these guys were very famous. And when he says the whole earth and all flesh had corrupted its way, that's indicating that all these people across here were getting involved in this. With, however, this exception. Look in verse 8. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. This is the genealogy of Noah. And you're going to go, well, he doesn't give a genealogy here. No, because he's going to say something about his genealogy. He's not going to give you a delineation of who his dad and so on and so forth. Noah was a righteous man. He was perfect or ceremonially clean in his generations. In other words, Noah didn't have any of this messed up, tainted blood in his bloodline. He had not been involved in this. His dad and granddad and so on and so forth back there had not become involved in this thing. Noah walked with God, and Noah begot these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they obviously are not involved in this problem yet. And so Noah was not involved with these sons, the sons of the Nephilim. In fact, Peter tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Now, there's different ways. That could be just by saying building the ark, he was a preacher of righteousness. But there's a good possibility that Noah could have simply been telling people, quit idolizing these guys. They're not a replacement for God. Is 9-9 really impressive to us? Yeah, it is. I grew up in Iowa. You'd go up to places out there that they called mountains, which are, they're smaller than going up the hill over here to the school from where I was. And then you go out and you find other places that are high. And then you come over here and we're really impressed by Rainier, aren't we? 14,000 feet. That is half the height elevation of K2 or Everest. Half the height. It always puts it in perspective. And yet if you look at the Earth from outer space, you don't look like going, look at those giant mountains sticking off the face of the Earth. Because even from outer space, those mountains are just like a blip on the skin of the earth. So it puts it in perspective. These guys, impressive to us, are nothing by comparison to God. And when it tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness, I think it's very likely that what he did was saying, it is not righteous that you guys should idolize these people, that you guys should want this. This is not right. But remember, what's man doing? He's got a conscience and he's trying to determine what'll make him happy and what'll make him miserable. And having a son or great-grandsons that are in the 10-foot range, that'll make me happy. You guys don't have one of these yet. We do. We've got three of them in our family. And this will make you happy. But what it's doing is it's bringing disaster on all of them. The thing that they think will make them happy in their conscience is actually bringing more and more disaster on them. So much so that eventually God's just going to wipe the whole human race out with a flood. It was to be their conscience that they should have, with their conscience, chosen what would have been good. And what would have been good would have been to do what Abel did. Continue to approach God and to bring a sacrifice before God and relate to God. And to be like Enoch, who in the middle of all this generational life, walks with God. And he never dies, by the way. His son Methuselah dies, apparently in the flood. So Methuselah apparently didn't do what his dad said. But his dad was taken and never saw death. That's a whole other thing. There's a lot. And I can't say, because I don't think from that point on that it never expresses specifically who ended up taking the reins in that. I'm just trying to say that. That's all I think I can say is that Cain was supposed to have been the manager. But he ends up choosing to go this other way. Maybe we could just say he is the manager, but Hey, you know what he does as he manages it? He makes a mess out of it. And I've known people that have had businesses that have hired managers, and the manager makes a disaster out of their business. So. Yeah, so Noah, as a preacher of righteousness, is telling them otherwise. Now let's just answer a quick question. What do we learn from the dispensation of conscience? Is there anything we learn from this dispensation? I would say, number one, conscience is not a safeguard for your life. Safe guide for your life. Okay? Because conscience can be corrupted by society. Your society around there is feeding into your conscience all the time about what will make you happy and what won't make you happy. And it's a constant battle. And the thing is, it's not oftentimes that conscience is going to come out and say, well, let's put it this way. I use an example of the beer commercials, because you see this in college towns. If you go into places that sell a lot of alcohol in college towns, they put up posters that you might not see in your town where they've got guys on the beach with girls in bikinis. This is, man, this will make me happy. Yeah. They don't say, hey, yeah, drink to excess until you're so drunk and you're miserable that the next day when you wake up, you're going to think, I'm never going to do that ever again. But you still end up stupidly going off and doing it again. See, culture corrupts. It's not blatant. It's not in your face saying, choose this bad thing. It makes a bad thing look enjoyable without you seeing the long-term consequence. Conscience does not guarantee that one will choose the good. That's the situation we had here, because society messes that up. And in fact, I want us to end with this verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And we'll end with this today. First Corinthians chapter 4, where the Apostle Paul says, and the New American Standard actually translates this accurately, it says, for I am conscious of nothing against myself. In other words, we could say Paul says, I've got a clear conscience in this. 4:4, I'm sorry. 1 Corinthians 4:4. I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this declared righteous. New American Standard says acquitted. Literally, it's declared righteous. But the one who examines me is the Lord. It's a reminder to us. And Paul does say in numerous times, my conscience will bear witness. As far as I'm concerned, I'm clear in my conscience. But Paul is also clear here. Just because your conscience is clear doesn't mean it's right. Because just because your conscience feels clear, just because your conscience seems good, maybe the knowledge aspect is messed up. Maybe culture has kind of messed up your conscience a little bit. That's over in, I think that's 1 Timothy chapter 4, where he's talking about people that have actually have a seared conscience. I think that's where it is. So, and we could spend a lot of time talking about conscience. It's not our main focus on us, but it's just for us to remember here at the end, we should learn from this that conscience is not really in the end your guide. Your guide is going to be, what does God say in his word? What does God tell you in his word is what he has for you? And how does he tell you in his word that you're to live? 1 Timothy 4:2, thank you. Okay, if you have some questions about any of this, you can come up and ask afterwards. Does anybody have one right now?
I was just wondering about the steward manager. It doesn't default to Abel?
It doesn't what?
It doesn't default to Abel after.
Abel's dead, yeah. It never tells us that it goes over to Seth. It simply says that Adam had a son in his image, called him Seth, that God gave him after the death of Abel and Cain. So maybe it did default to Seth, but it doesn't tell us that specifically. So
somewhere I've read where Seth is called a prophet.
Abel is called a prophet. Seth, I don't know if Seth is. Okay, but I know Abel is called a prophet over in the New Testament, which meant that he had to have revelation. That's in Luke, and that Jesus calls him a prophet over there, and that meant that Abel had to have revelation from God that he was giving out to people. So, okay. Father, we're thankful for the time you've given us together. We're thankful that we can know good and evil, but it is not ultimately based on our conscience that we know good and evil today. We actually are able to know what makes us happy because you revealed it to us in your word. And yet we're inundated constantly by our own fleshly desires as well as the culture in which we live that tries to tell us what will be good, and yet almost always it's presenting an alternative to your good. What would really make us happy always is something that will actually bring about disaster. And help us to be those that would then learn to follow the lead of your Spirit, follow what you say in your word in such a way that we would really come to know what is truly good. And we would thank you for this then. Amen.